Nickel. Right, this is class number four based on this book, The Intimate Way of Zen by James Ishmael Ford, my Dharma uncle. And just to briefly recap, if you are joining us about this book for the first time, this is kind of loosely about the journey or the spiritual path, aspects of development and growth and discovery on the spiritual path. And it's loosely structured on the Oxfording pictures, the 10 Oxfording pictures, which are hundreds of years old, came from China and show somebody searching for an ox, which is the ox stands for the great mystery, you know, our heart's longing. And at first, we're just wandering. Then we see the footprints of the ox. Then we catch a glimpse of the ox. Then we manage to capture the ox and tame it, ride it home, forget about it. And then, you know, I don't know, disappear into oneness. So we are on Oxfording picture number two, and the two chapters tonight. That's where we're seeing the footprints. We're on the path. We know we're on the path. And the chapter seven is false friends and true. And chapter eight is coaches, teachers, and guides. So the first chapter then, talking about the importance of good friends to our spiritual path. And this is actually from the end of this chapter. I'll backtrack. But Ford says, friendship has many faces, and there are no real lists of how one can go about finding good friends and being one. Boundaries are part of it. That's important. And so I repeat, boundaries are part of it, as is abandon. Getting the mix right is hard. And me, I've experienced getting it wrong a lot. But to have a worthwhile life, we need friends. If we aspire to the mysteries of love that become that great dance, we must give ourselves to friendship, even if it means stepping on a toe now and then, or having our own foot trod on. Friendship, intimate friendship, is about that opening of the heart. It's about seeing our relationships fully as path. And then he also shares a very, very well-known quote from the Buddha. So this is from the Pali Canon, from some of the oldest Buddhist scriptures. One day while walking together, out of the silence, the Buddha's attendant Ananda declared, "Teacher, to have companions and comrades on the great way is so amazing. I have come to realize that friendship is fully half of an authentic spiritual life." They proceeded along quietly for a while more before, out of that silence, the Holy One responded, "No, dear one. Without companions and comrades, no one can live into the deep, finding the true harmonies of life to achieve authentic wisdom. To say it simply, friendship is the whole of the spiritual life." So, Ford, of course, explores. I mean, what do we mean by friends? And he admits, no doubt friendship as we use it is a mutable term with casual and more profound meanings. Mutable meaning changeable. Because he said, are Facebook friends your friends? You know, so I mean, we're talking about relationships, all different kinds of relationships, acquaintances, the kind of conditional friendships we have where, you know, we've just happened to work with somebody or we have shared interests. I've had friendships where essentially some just by chance, we ended up just kind of trading favors, you know, and it's so there's not a huge amount in common or a great amount of like rapport, but it's kind of a, I don't know, I guess you could say it's a friendship based in mutual generosity. Sometimes it's just years in the same group or community, you know, within a sangha. We'll have friends of all kinds, hopefully, and I've talked about this before, we will have at least one, maybe a couple, maybe more people who we just naturally you know, have a resonance with and have stuff in common with and like and feel comfortable with, and they can become, you know, real Dharma friends, right? And then, but then there's all kinds of other folks who you've been to retreat with, you've done term student with, that you've gotten to know in the breakout rooms, and you know, you get to know them somewhat and practice by their side, and so those are friends too, even if they're not in the same way. Sometimes you have friends based just on shared experiences, good or bad. People who've just, you know, you went to school with, you've just kind of lived each other, you know, live life near each other. But then, of course, there's mutual affection. And then there's what I find is very rare in my life anyway, are what I call committed friendships, where it's like you understand that you're in this for the long haul. It's not a matter of like, don't really have time to see Erica anymore. I don't know, the last few times we went out, yeah, I don't know, we don't have that much in common anymore. So then I just let it drift away, right? As opposed to, I don't know if you have folks like this, but you know, like you are my friend, and even if you piss me off, and even if we drift apart or whatever, like we will remain friends. Will remain some kind of connection, and I will be there for you if you need it, that kind of thing. All kinds of different friends. And I think the Buddha, when he was saying, you know, friendship is the whole of the spiritual life, I think he was including all of these kinds of friends, all of these relationships that we have that we rely on in various ways. And obviously, each kind of friend will have a different kind of influence on us, a different degree of influence on us. So, you know, part of this, I mean, there's so many dimensions to it, and I'll invite people to reflect on that. How have your friends, part of the Sangha or not, Buddhist or not, presently in your life or in the past, helped you along your spiritual path? How has a friend or friends helped you along your path? So, as social creatures, we understand, and Ford talks about this, you know, we're profoundly influenced by those who are around us. It's very difficult for us to act very differently from the people around us. And that can be a positive or negative thing, right? If they're doing something unhealthy, it's going to be difficult to stand apart from that and not indulge in it, especially if it's something that we're, you know, kind of drawn to. But then if they're all doing something positive, then it's almost kind of difficult not to do that thing along with them. And that's why I like to go to the gym, right? Everybody's working out there. We're all doing the same thing. So I'm not saying that, I'm not trying to vilify people, you know, if they're not Buddhist, if they're not in the Sangha, whatever, as if there's people out here who are bad friends. But certainly there are people we might encounter, friends, family, whatever, who for a large part are aiming only to maximize pleasure or profit. or minimize work, or to dwell in resentment or despair. You know, it's very, very difficult to be around people who just, you know, keep on the same miserable narrative, right? How they've been wronged, or how this is terrible, and it can be, and we can have sympathy for folks like that, but then it also, like, it takes a lot of energy. We certainly don't, like, feel regenerated from being around that. Sometimes people are seeking refuge in intoxicants or gambling or other behaviors that are unhealthy in excess. It can be difficult to be around that. I have a nephew who just decided to up and leave the town that he grew up in and move for the first time to another city, in part because all of his friends were just smoking pot all the time. And kind of as long as he was there, he would just, that's what he'd be doing, and not really much else. So really, he just had to get a clean break. Versus, you know, being around people who see life as practice, who doubt what we think, who are aiming for growth, who are curious about the great matter. So how have your friends, part of the Sangha or not, Buddhist or not, presently in your life or in the past, helped you along your spiritual path? I mean, there's many ways that people can help us, right? I mean, because it's kind of indirect support, right? Because, like, my husband has essentially allowed this Zen Center to develop by supporting me for many years as I poured myself into this until I could grow it to the point where it actually supports me, at least in part. But if I had had to be supporting myself all the way along, I wouldn't have been able to do that. So indirectly, he supported that. But this is a little bit, I don't know, I guess to me, the question points to, is pointing to something a little bit different. And I guess when I, if I was to answer that question, I would think of my good Dharma, my close Dharma friends, who I would be able to, and I'm still able to, talk to them about the most subtle and unformed spiritual experiences and doubts and questions I was experiencing. You know, they really, in a way, because they have enough, we have enough in common, and they know how to, like, listen patiently, that they can, you know, they're not just going to give advice or be just like, ah, you know, what's that about? To understand that, like, I say, I don't know, feel each day like there's a little something separating me from my experience. I'm trying to feel into that, or I don't know, you know, something. I hopefully you've had these kinds of conversations with Dharma friends, because and you just step back and realize, like, almost no one else would have any idea what we were talking about. And because I was able to do that, it's almost like it all becomes, it helps me to get in touch with that experience, to speak about it with somebody, and to have somebody report on their own kind of subjective existential experience. So that's my example. I do, if anybody's curious, I have quite a few. If you just go to the Zen Studies podcast and type in friendship in the search, I have several episodes on Sangha, and then two on the value, care, and feeding of Dharma friendships. So if you just want to stew in it a little more. So I don't know if anybody has anything they want to share about their Dharma friends, Dharma friendships. I mean, whether they, the friend may not have called it a Dharma friendship, but might have been a, or even a parent or a teacher or a person, a human being. Or how your Sangha members are helping your spiritual path now.
I mean, I guess I don't know that I have anything in particular, but yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm pretty lucky in that respect. I have friends who, I have the ability to be able to talk to them about spiritual things, existential things. I have a friend who said, yeah, I was talking to myself by the refrigerator. I realized I was talking to my dead grandfather. It's like they feel so comfortable saying that. Or, they, as a hospice nurse who said that she saw and felt somebody's spirit as the person died. And to be able to have conversations, because I've had similar experiences, and just to be able to have conversations that are not just about the weather and just basic stuff, and really deep conversations, and explore some of those ideas without having anybody be judgy about it, I think is super important. And as I've set out on my Buddhist way, one of my very best friends is very religious and Christian, and she has been just so lovely and not judgy. And when I go over, her son wants to be a minister and he prays with me, which I think is like the most lovely thing ever, because he's young and he's like, he just really believes what he's doing, and he's doing that because he loves me and it has nothing to do. It's his thing. He loves me and he wants to pray with me. And I just find that we can mix our beliefs together beautifully without any sort of judgment. So
Thank you. Total. I have a few, I have two of those friends that you're saying that we're just in it. I mean, I've been friends with them since I was like daycare age. And like, I'd have to say they probably have pissed me off more than they've the other, like at in my 30s now, but I love them so much. Oh my God. But when I think about the Dharma, it's not something that I ever talk to anybody outside really about. I mean, they know it's something that I do. And I'm thinking, well, have my friends helped me outside of Dharma related things? And I can't think of anything. And it's really I think it's really unfair to my friends, because if I would have asked for help, they would help me. I know that for certain. So I'm reflecting on maybe whether I should be asking for help more often. So that's something that's come up for me now, that maybe I've kind of not allowed my friends to do that for me. Yeah.
I mean, that does raise a very, I don't know, it raises a really interesting question. If like the darn, this is all about spiritual friends. Can we maybe live in kind of a closed way? I was talking to my cousin
when I was home and just saying, I don't have a lot of friends. I mean, I have a lot of people I care about, but I don't see them very often. They're busy, I'm busy, whatever. And I said, and I can't be friends with the people in my sangha, right? Because I can't be special friends with anybody, right? Like, oh, we're going out to eat. But then other people are gonna be like, well, what am I? So anyway, I had told her about that. And then we were at a doings celebration of life, and she was talking to somebody, and I came up and I wanted to talk to my cousin, and I didn't know this lady, but I just kind of waited, and the lady was talking about something I had no idea, right? And she kind of explained a little bit, whatever. I didn't think anything of it. But then later my cousin was like, now you I think you're, she says to me, she says, I think you're one of the most pe interesting people I know. And yet you're kind of standoffish when you were like approach this, this woman. And I'm like, I don't, but I really like, it's almost like a lot of times people aren't even on my radar. When I'm here at the Zen Center, it's really sweet. Like everybody's on my radar, right? Like you're all coming here and I'm interested in all of you, but then I step out the door and kind of like, eh, I got things to do, places to go. So does it raise that question of like how open are we and how interdependent are we allowing ourselves to be?
Yeah.
Tyler.
Yeah. I guess I've been thinking about this a lot lately as I've been sort of wrestling with the idea of like my practice as a cloud member and not as not having like a physical zendo around and a sangha booth. And it's interesting. I think what it's done though really is it's really helped me to understand how different and special a relationship is within a sangha that I don't think, like, again, I've said this, I don't know how long I keep saying I'm new at this, but I still feel like I'm new at this spiritual life business. Then I run into other people and I feel like there's just like I want to connect with them in this way, but they don't like they're if I said some of the things, yeah, if I said some of the things that we talk about, they'd be like, okay, that's weird or whatever. There's just like all these things that I get to do with this community here that's so special. And it's not that they haven't had other special relationships outside of this, but there is something different about it that I'm just coming to notice in this past sort of 6 to 8 months of my life and how special this is and how it'd be great to be able to have those sorts of connections with the greater community, but I haven't quite figured out a way to do that. 'Cause there seems, I don't know, there's just some connection with all of us that, I mean, some of us might be closer than others. We're not all going to be, best friends. But yeah, I don't know. It's just the last few months I've noticed how special a spiritual connection and friendship is.
Yeah, I mean, and I feel like we have a fair amount in common with spiritual communities of any kind who conceive of their of being on a spiritual path. Pretty much no matter, and so if you were to look at the Christians and Jews and Muslims and whatever, like it's kind of funny, but to find those folks, like just kind of judging from the outside, you're talking about the kooky, crazy religious people, right? Like we're kind of on a par with like the Christians who go to their Bible study every Wednesday and they go on their spiritual retreats and they go, like people who really like practice their religion. So it's kind of funny because like I'm kind of like from the outside, I don't think I'm like this really spiritual, religious person, but I guess, it's kind of a really big part of my life. So I've noticed that I have more in common with, devout Christians and Jehovah's Witnesses and whatever than with just kind of the average person who just doesn't doesn't spend their time and energy doing these things.
I just,
Rachel. Oh, go ahead, Tyler.
oh no, so just that, I remember a while back you said something to this flavor, and I realized I've got JW neighbors who have their Bible study in their backyard regularly. And at first I moved in here, I was like, that's really kind of odd. But then one day I was like, oh, what'd be so nice to have my Dharma friends over to my backyard to talk about the oh. When you said that, I was like, oh dear. Okay.
We could read scripture to each other.
Lovely.
We could go and slow kin-hin through the neighborhood. Oh my gosh. Rachel.
I feel kind of the same way as Tyler does, where it's we have this connection, but because we're on the cloud, it's kind of hard to nurture it, I feel. But also it's not hard to nurture it. I know that I am not the most, I can't say that. I was gonna say I'm not the most talkative person, but I'm talking right now, so I can't really say that I am not a talkative person. But I am very insecure about like how I come off to other people and things. So I try not to step on toes and things like that. And I feel like that makes it harder for me to open to other people. And that's not anyone's fault but mine. But it does make me think of like, how do I open up to making Dharma friends if I'm so afraid of offending them or stepping on toes or anything like that, if a question rubs someone the wrong way and things like that. And I always feel kind of like, how do I know I made this friend though? Is it because they like me or do they just like what I said and then just want me to shut up? What I mean, it's really hard. Trying to understand how connections work, I guess. Well, for me anyway, it's kind of hard to figure out like, did I make this connection? Did I fall? Things like that. So that's where I'm at in my journey on, yeah.
Well, the next chapter in my book, which I have yet to get around to, and now I've got a retreat and all that, but is relationships and opening the heart. And I want to include that as one of the 10 fields of Zen practice, because it's like the ancestors didn't explicitly like draw it out and talk about it, but I think this is like the modern influence of psychology and stuff, where we're more conscious of this stuff. And I feel like Sangha is an amazing place. If you commit to Sangha, you commit to being part of the community long term, whether you're feeling it or not. You have the opportunity to work through a lot of your relationship karma, right? Because whatever kind of issues tend to come up with you in relation to other people will come up in Sangha. Your social anxiety will come up in Sangha, or to confess, I tend to be, or tended to be, not of all of you, because they're totally different. I tended to be very critical, right? Like, that person is just a little too much that way, a little bit too much that way. This person, and in a way, all I could see was their faults and their flaws, and not just a kind of an open-hearted kindness, which over time, because all of this stuff plays out, and I'm not therefore avoiding everybody. Because I'm just part of the Sangha. If it was just like a bunch of friends, I might be like, meh, I'm done with this. But I continue, watch all of it happen, and recognize over time that this is all about me, right? This is all about my own lack of acceptance of myself and my own defendedness and inability to just be open-hearted, because I might get rejected like I was in grade school, right? We just like can't get over this stuff. and to be more open and friendly, and this fear of rejection where we're like, and then if somebody rejects us, they're right. As opposed to if we're kind and we offer our friendship and somebody is rude or rebuffs us, like that's their problem, right? I mean, that's totally their problem. So anyway, with you have work out amazing things within the midst of Sangha. So that's like the usefulness of friends too, right? We tend to think like, oh, friends were kind and they were supportive and they were fun to talk to, but friends can help our spiritual practice in many ways, not just the obvious positive ones. Brian.
Uh-oh.
You're still, you're muted.
Well, sure about okay. Okay. It made me think about when I was working, and I worked all over the world, all these different countries and that stuff. And we called it baptism by fire. Your friends of fire. It's like when you're in the war or something like that. These people you work with, and in the worst situations, and you came to rely on them, and they are still your friends because you always knew they'd never let you down. I see this being trend now happening in the Sangha. I'm a cloud Zendo. I've never been to the center, but my friends are in the cloud. We talk. We are example. If you're in, let's just say even the podcast group or the Metta group, we have become very intimate, very open. And very pointed and letting our feelings show. And what I found from those people is that they've walked the walk, they can talk the talk. They've been through it, they're maybe a year or so ahead of me, 2 years ahead of me, and things that I'm coming up against now, they've been through, and they give you advice. And I think that's really great. So I'm seeing that same feeling I had at work happening within the cloud group. And they basically never seen them except on the screen. But I feel attached to them. I trust them. And I think the feeling is mutual. And I think that's really quite nice. So
Thank you for speaking up for the cloud friendships. All right, so let's move on to chapter two. The chapter two always gets the short end of the stick in our discussions, but that's only because the discussions are garbage. So the second chapter is coaches, teachers, and guides. And let's
see. What's happening is wrong.
Oh.
Instead, you said the discussions are garbage.
Let's see. Just to read a few words from James. Says all spiritual traditions offer guidance on the way, and that guidance takes a lot of shapes. My experience and observation suggest some of these ways of receiving guidance are more useful than others. The actual mix and what's best in that mix is no doubt going to be different for each of us. That said, some of these ingredients are helpful for nearly all of us, and one of those is to earnestly take the role of student in relation to teachers of all various kinds. Just as books can show us the breadth of our companionship on the way, they can also serve to an extent as teachers. And he talks about how community can be a teacher. So we've been talking a little bit about that, although kind of community as a whole can be a teacher too, not just the individuals in it. Because cats, trees, books, monasteries, oxen, or even just their spoor, all of these can be teachers. But what about the messier ones? Humans. So there is an axiom of the intimate way. Starting out and well into the path, without guides, you will probably not find the treasure. The traps and snares of the ego are powerful. There are too many blank spots and worn edges on the maps. We need help. There are no hard rules for looking for a guide on the intimate way. Awakening happens to whom it does. So a teacher needn't be credentialed. You can absolutely find a genuinely wise butcher, master sergeant, or geology professor. Awakening happens. But when it happens outside of the context of a tradition, usually that person has a lot of trouble helping others. Because their awakening just happened, they likely don't have much of a system to impart to others, and they might guide you straight into mistakes or dead ends. For all the problems with teachers within traditions, attachments to hierarchy, getting too used to their own power, narcissism, and what have you, I still think they have the best chance of being competent guides. So most of the best teachers are found within traditions, but the best of those are not trapped by the limitations of their tradition. So, very briefly, I thought I would say something about what it means to be a Zen teacher in our lineage. So I began practice as a lay person. I did lay practice for 5 years, and then I really wanted to do monastic practice full time. So my teacher ordained me as a monk, and then I lived at the Zen Center full time and was on the schedule full time for 7 years, and then for several more, I lived nearby, but I was still pretty much there all the time and on staff and all that kind of stuff. So that was really, you know, very close practice with my teacher for 15 years. So yeah, close to 10 of those full time. And during that time, I did just what you all are doing. You know, went to classes, and we had daily zazen throughout the week, morning and evening, and you know, serving the sangha and going to retreats, doing term student, all of that kind of stuff. Just, you know, absorbing myself in all the things that the sangha does. And I learned all the practice roles, you know, I learned how to do Doan and do the ceremonies and, you know, be a Tenzo and cook for retreats. And we didn't have Sangha Connector at the time, but I would have learned that too, right? Just like all the practice roles within the Sangha. I learned and practical stuff too. I've talked about this before where I, you know, from Kyogen, I learned, you know, how to do a newsletter, and you know, how to keep a database of your members, and how to keep a budget, and all that kind of stuff. So practical things. And I just we say sometimes people come to Zen and they're like, okay, you know, okay, what should I do? What should I study? But in Soto Zen in particular, we say time and proximity. So you just time and proximity. And you're not even quite sure what's happening. but then over time, like when I listen to the recordings of the Sangha Voices talks from August, I was kind of like, I mean, I don't mean to be like demeaning, but I felt kind of like a proud parent, right? I'm like, yeah, something's happening, you know? And it's like what? I mean, if you ask any of those folks who gave talks, like, you know, what did you do? What has been your study? What if they'd be like, you know, it's just something that you start to absorb. It's just something you imprint on. you get used to, you get to know the language, you get familiar. And I could tell when, I got to the point after, I don't know, maybe 10 years of just sitting nearby, listening to my teacher's talks, listening to them answer questions, listening to their dharma, that I could answer the way they would answer, right? So if somebody asked a question, I could give, I like to make the parting line, right? I could kind of channel my teachers and give an answer, even if I was going to follow up and say, and I found, right? Like I could add a bit about my own personal experience or another tip or something like that, but I could speak from the tradition. And that's when I feel like I was really starting to get in my bones. So it's really kind of an apprenticeship model, right? It's not like how long does it take? How many courses do you have to do? It's just more, work by my side, and then at some point I'll be like, yeah, I think you're a journeyman now, or like, so there's never any guarantee that your teacher's gonna, transmit you, which means empower you to be an independent teacher. And that for many people, that's not even going to be appropriate, right? I mean, if that's not what you want to do, then there's no point in that. You can still be like fully realized and embodying the path, but maybe you serve in a different way. Maybe your, primary interest is outside the Sangha. But so after 15 years of practicing closely with my teacher, then she transmitted the Dharma to me. But that's, I mean, that's like, getting your teaching certificate, and you're not like, I am the best teacher in the world. Like now you can just start, right? So now it's been it's getting close to 15 years since that. So hopefully starting to kind of get it. And I have a podcast episode on Dharma transmission and what it means and doesn't mean. And it can sound kind of mystical, but it's not a perfect system by any means, right? There are, as it, if you don't know about it, I don't even want to really tell you about it, but many of you are familiar that like there's many spiritual teachers, Buddhist, Zen, who have, ethical violations, just, made a mess of things, usually sexual improprieties with students, and not just in like, on occasion, okay, a teacher and a student happen to fall in love. Oh, okay. But like, there are ways to go about that, and like the student can, no longer be their student, and they can be above board and all of that. But that rarely happens, right? Usually it's an illicit thing on the side, and the spouses are upset, and the Sangha is torn apart, and all kinds of stuff like that. Or it's a serial thing, right? It's the teacher just taking advantage of students and convincing them that this is, good for their spiritual path. So it just because somebody like gets credentialed does not mean that you should entrust yourself to them. However, I also have a podcast episode about, what does it mean to these unethical teachers? Does it mean they were never enlightened? Does it mean that anything they did is not legitimate anymore? It's complicated. But it's something. It's better than nothing, right? It's better than just somebody going out there and putting out a shingle and saying, I'm a Zen teacher. I mean, it's a free country. Any of you could do that tomorrow, right? You could just go start a zendo. But if you, what you learn after a while is like you inquire, okay, where did this person train? What's their lineage? What did their teachers do? And how about their teachers? And so that you have this kind of this grounding tradition. And there have been numerous examples where these teachers have done these ethical violations and have not subsequently kind of done the work to heal the situation and, you know, allow themselves to be held accountable, then they're cut off from various organizations like the Soto Zen Buddhist Association and sometimes even their own lineage organizations. So you can find that out, right? Like the rest of their peers will have said, you know, we don't endorse this person anymore. It's valuable to know, because he talks a little bit in this chapter about like this kind of thing. We do have an ethics policy at Bright Way. It's part, if I'm going to, I mean, it's a good idea anyway, but if I'm going to belong to the Soto Zen Buddhist Association, which is at this point an association of priests, I have to have an ethics policy. And it includes grievance procedures, whatever, and it's right on our website. So it has strict guidelines, particularly for any teachers. Maybe I might not be the only teacher here someday. For any teachers here, including no sexual relationships with students, you know, no misuse of funds and power and things like that. So it's very similar and actually probably even less strict in some ways than what you would just expect when you go to a counselor or psychologist. And then I also, just in terms of, and I've given talks on this before, but like there are many different teachers, like we talked about. And I think Sangha is our greatest teacher. But in terms of a teacher, a Zen teacher, there's many different ways in which you can engage a teacher and enroll in that or embody that student space. You can just, I mean, all of you right now are doing that. Just by wandering into the Zen Center, you are doing that. So in a sense, I'm a teacher just in like the space I create and the information I share and the, you know, tradition that I can teach. So it's just like, I remember one of my good friends was a yoga teacher, and I mean, like a friend, like we are the same age and we had kind of grown up in the Dharma together. So it felt kind of weird for her to like come to my Dharma talks, right? I'm like, why do you want to come to one of my Dharma talks? But she was like, well, that's what you do. I'm a yoga teacher. If you came to my yoga studio, I would teach you yoga. So I'm like, oh, okay, that's cool. It's not like I'm a Dharma teacher because I'm so incredibly brilliant and enlightened. That's just what I do. But then there are other ways that people can engage. You know, members can meet with me every few months or as often as once a month on Zoom. I talk about your practice. There's one-on-one meetings during retreats. Some folks are working on what we call Zaike Tokudo, which is staying at home to accomplish the way, as opposed to Shuke Tokudo, which is monastic ordination, leaving home to accomplish the way. And I say that is if for folks who have been involved for like 3 to 5 or more years, and helping to nourish, sustain, and transmit the three treasures, you want to make it part of your bodhisattva path. So you really want like being part of Sangha and sharing this tradition and making Sangha available is part of how you want to live. Not only, right? Like you might have other things going on. Otherwise, you might ordain as a monk or a priest. So anyway, and so all this is just informative. I don't have long. I'm not suggesting a path for anyone to follow. All of the things here at Brightway, everything that we do is offered, and it's not like if you don't have to like sign up for the program. And hopefully, I encourage all of you to enact this cultural ideal, which is that we never pressure people or judge people for what they choose to be involved in or not. Right? So maybe receiving the precepts and formally becoming a Buddhist was very meaningful to you. It might not be what the person next to you wants to do. They might stay at the Zen Center for 20 years and not and choose never to do that. I know a woman who did not want to do that because she was also Jewish and just didn't feel like felt like she had already made her commitment, and to become something else didn't feel right. So anyway, I hope all of you embody that as well in terms of teacher stuff. But I will just a few minutes here. I'll just leave you with a question that once again, we don't have much time to discuss. But do you find yourself able to inhabit the position of student? And when you find yourself doing that, what does that mean to you? Do you like the role too much? Like, do you kind of just go into like, oh yes, teach me, like, or do you kind of resist the role? Or somewhere in between? I can be a really, really good student if I want to be. If, like I'm voluntarily going in here and I am deciding this is what I want to learn, and therefore I am opening myself up to it. But like, yeah, it has to be voluntary. I'm not just like wide open, does teach me anything, which maybe I should be, but I have noticed, seeing I'll just share things. We don't really have any time for anybody else to share. To be totally honest, right? So I was my teacher's student. I mean, I still am, right? But really for like 15 years, right? And so was very, very open to her and to her guidance, and allowing her to see all aspects of myself. And I mean, it's not like I wanted her approval. I mean, obviously at certain karmic levels I did, but I wanted what she had to teach, right? I wanted to learn what she had to teach. And there was a turning toward her, and I don't know, almost felt kind of captive in a way. So even when it was really difficult, I didn't want to give up because I hadn't gotten what I wanted to get yet. So it can be like the whole learning process, whether you're studying Zen or you're studying a martial art or you're studying music or whatever, it's not always easy, right? Sometimes it's really hard, and your coach or your teacher or whatever is hard on you, or you got to do stuff you don't want to do. So it was kind of a relief when I completed that process. And part of the whole process of moving toward Dharma transmission is like, getting over that and realizing you have everything you need in a really deep, sincere way, not just in a superficial way. So I was kind of relieved that I didn't have to like be someone's student anymore, right? But then like recently I've decided to go and kind of do some continuing education with the Hogan Bays. And there's part of me just like, like for what, like 15 years, no one's like, slapped me around, not literally, right? Nobody's, given me the eyebrow and made me doubt myself, right? Nobody, like, I haven't opened myself up in that way for a long time to a person. I mean, certainly to the Dharma, to certain teachings and whatever, but to a person, which is like, it's much scarier to open yourself up like that to a person. So it's very interesting to see that come up again. I was just kind of like, nah, I don't. But then I'm like, do I have to go there? Do I have to go into this sense of like, now I'm in the one down position with this person? So I'm actually thinking, why do I have to? Why can't I learn? I mean, it's not a humiliating thing to admit that I don't know everything in the world. So anyway, I'll leave that question for you to ponder. How do you find yourself able to inhabit the position of student? And what does that mean to you? Right. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. All right. Thank you all for coming, and see many of you tomorrow.